We are in 2 Samuel chapter 8. We've been going through the life of David. Now, of course, we're progressing on through that life. It's a little bit more of a good battle stories. I like those good battle stories. They're always fun to talk about. Open the prayer if you don't mind.
Almighty God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we thank you for your time you've given to us for the Shabbat. We ask you to bless the Shabbat and bless our reading today and our discussion, that it go well, that we follow your word, your guidance, and your eyes. We thank you for giving us this opportunity to always learn more about you, to be better our own lives, so we may learn to follow you more closely. We trust you, God, and ask for your presence. Thank you, son, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.
After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Metheg Ammah from the hand of the Philistines. Then he defeated Moab, forcing them down to the ground. He measured them off with a line. With two lines he measured off these to be put to death, and with one full line those to be kept alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. Also David hamstrung all the chariot horses, except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus. And the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that had belonged to the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. Also from Bethah and from Berathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took a large amount of bronze. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, then Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him, because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him. For Hadadezer had been at war with Toi. And Joram brought with him articles of silver, articles of gold, and articles of bronze. King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Syria, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, from Amalek, and from the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. And David made himself a name when he returned from killing 18,000 Syrians in the Valley of Salt. He also put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord preserved David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel, and David administered judgment and justice to all his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were the priest. Zeruiah was the scribe. Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over both the Cherethites and the Pelethites. And David's sons were chief ministers. That was the one with all the names, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Had a lot of names in it. They actually periodically show up chapters like that. I think that's why you got volunteered to read it. So that was 2 Samuel chapter 8. Thank you, Dave, by the way, for reading that. Any questions or comments before I go into my little spiel about this? Seems like a fairly straightforward chapter. Emmy?
So, they say here that David's sons were already acting as ministers.
Right.
How old would these boys have been by now, do you think? How many years between, like, when he was in Hebron, for example, and maybe this point?
It depends on which son he's referring to. The eldest son would be Absalom, which we're familiar with. No, he was the second oldest? Oh, I forgot. Amnon was the oldest. That's right. Absalom, Amnon. They're the oldest, but they were born David in Hebron. Now, of course, taking out these various countries is not an overnight prospect. They don't have, you know, our nice little new equipment we have today for going to battle. This has been years going by of doing this process. These sons were senior ministers, I mean, senior advisors to David, and, of course, assisting him. So he was essentially training them on how to be king. Their exact ages, hard to say. When David took control of Jerusalem 7 years after he became king, because these sons were born to him when he was in Hebron, the oldest would be somewhere around 7, 8 years old when he took Jerusalem. And then how many years from Jerusalem till these events happened, we don't know. It's been guessed because the sons to be ministers have to be at least be able to go to war, meaning they're at least 20 or so years old, give or take. They don't know the exact age. I don't believe he had a son. It's not recorded that he had him before Hebron. So these are sons he had in Hebron. Now, he brought up a lot of them. Since David went to and from Hebron the whole time, during, you know, the time which he was fleeing Saul, he passed through it periodically. We don't know if, you know, some of his family were there or not, or whether he, you know, left sons there to be raised. We don't know that how many years they've been there before he arrived as king. So their exact ages, we don't know. Most likely over the age of 20 are his sons. At least two sons or more, because they're plural. We don't know how many, though, for certain. They go into battles, and we'll deal with them over the next few chapters, what his sons actually do. Any other comments or questions regarding this chapter? Well, I have a question. What's David doing? Establishing himself? Yeah, I'd say he established himself pretty well. Little map up here, if you can't tell, and some of you in the back probably can't see it all that well. It shows Israel right about here, near close to the center of the map. And it shows the various cities that were mentioned in this story, as well as the countries. My little dotted line, a little red line that borders between, approaches Turkey, over to the Euphrates River, down through part of Edom, and goes to Amalek. By the time David dies, and Solomon takes control, that's the size of Israel. It controls from the Wadi of Egypt all the way up to the Euphrates River. Not whole, like, occupied by Israelis, Israelite citizens, no. But as far as kings paying tribute to David. What was David's goal in all this? We discussed this in the previous chapter, when David realized what task God was assigning him. His goal was to collect money. A lot of it. Because Solomon was getting a whole lot of cash, a whole lot of materials, a lot of supplies, in order to build the design of the temple that David had constructed. I mean, he designed it. David designed it, Solomon constructs it. So David knows what supplies and how much he's going to need. So where is he going to get it from? Well, unlike our current society, so we'll just tax the people. David's realm lifestyle was not, you know, you don't tax Israel to get this cash. You go to the extra neighbors and get it from them. And we're like, well, this was brutal. We saw, oh, look what he did to Moab. His captives, he took what, one-third of them, measured off of the rope, and two-thirds, and he killed two-thirds of his captives of Moab. That was brutal. We call that a war crime today. Killing your hostages, killing your captives in battle. He'd be, you know, strung up, and I don't know what they do in war criminals nowadays. They continue to throw on trial for like 50 years before they actually do anything. But it'd be a war crime. Who wouldn't do that today? Is this unfair of David? Why would he do this to Moab? What did they ever do to him? Why would you go along to his own relatives? By the way, David's related to Moabites. His own relatives attack and take the captives and slaughter two-thirds of them. Yes, Ellie.
Maybe they didn't want to give him their money?
Most likely nobody wants to give anybody their money. This has been a long-standing question. There is no explicit reason why David treats Moab differently than everybody else. There's hypotheticals, there's beliefs, and there's traditions. There's also one other theory, too, which I'll throw out there probably at the end. Common tradition. You don't agree or not, doesn't make a difference. I'll tell you what the tradition is, which I mentioned this previously in previous chapters. David, while he was fleeing Saul, She recalled what he did with his family, his mother, his father, a few of his brothers, a few of their children. Where did he put them? Moab. He gave them to Moab. He said, hey, king of Moab, I'm fleeing Saul. My family is not safe in the territory of Israel, into the boundaries, because Saul can use them against me. Please take care of them for me outside of Israel's territory, outside of Saul's reach, while I'm dealing with this. What did the king of Moab say? Sure, no problem. We'll take care of them. Tradition states, just tradition. Once David left Moab's presence, he had his mother, father, and anybody who's with him slaughtered. Why? Why would King Moab do that? What purpose would it gain him? What would the objective be?
Come back.
What, say it again?
So he wouldn't come back.
So that David wouldn't come back? That probably wouldn't be a very effective rule, effective method. You'd like to get David angry. So Saul wouldn't attack him? Possibly, Moab at this point in time in Saul's reign was much stronger than Saul and the Israelites. They didn't do a whole lot. They had their own battles with Edom, but they were stronger than Saul was. They were busy picking fights with Amalek at the time, too. So it was kind of a, yeah, we'll deal with you later. Let's deal with the bigger problems. What does the king of Moab know about David at this time when David asks this request? Well, king of Moab knows that David is one of Saul's best military men. That David, with a small number of men, has been able to outstrip and destroy armies 10 to 15 times his own size and not lose anybody. He's a fantastic ambusher. So Moab has reason to believe that David is someone you fear or keep at arm's length. If Moab, this is just tradition, by the way, that this king did this. We don't have any proof of this of the sort, nothing of the sort. But there's a little bit more evidence, which I'll talk about to you in a few minutes. Tradition states the king of Moab said, all right, David, you're going to one day probably become king. Whatever I can do to not help you, I will do it. And kills off David's family. Just tradition. Now, there is one other clue that might give a little bit of hint, is that in a few chapters from now, David goes off and sends a garrison or a group to the king of Ammon, just north of Moab, and says to thank him. Thank the king for his kindness during David's flight from Saul. And you ask yourselves, wait a minute, you look back, I don't see any record of David ever having any acknowledgement experience whatsoever with Ammon during this fleeing from Saul. Tradition states that the people who survived Moab's destruction ran out to Ammon and stayed there, and the king of Ammon took care of them. Just tradition. There's a couple other things about it, why David would treat Moab this way. And the Psalms 60 gives a small amount of hint just of what the cause would be. Any comments or issues regarding this so far? Yes, David.
One thing I'm kind of... is him hamstringing those horses. You know, it's that almost seems kind of mean, to be honest.
More brutality.
It's, yeah, pretty brutal. I mean, you know, I would almost rather see a horse put down than hamstrung. Not that I'm a horse fan or anything, but
right,
I mean,
right.
Just...
The kindest to animals type of thing.
Well...
Essentially.
Yeah. So.
Which it gives you a similar character. David the Moab, hamstring the horses. I mean, what kind of man is this? How brutal of a person is he? Is he just mean? Is that the problem? He's just a mean guy? Jeff?
Maybe he's turning tanks into cargo trucks.
That is, in the case for horses, absolutely true. In the case for Moab, sort of true. okay. Now I'll pose you a few questions. I'm going to give you a couple more answers. Psalm 60 We're not going to read the whole psalm, but David wrote this psalm in response to a number of these battles. He assesses that the problem or the cause as to why he attacks these individuals with such brutality and such harshness. It is the last few verses of Psalms, which granted the English translation is rather poor, but a few translations do okay with it. We just the last few verses of the psalm itself. Let's see, it's here was it? I'll start verse 12. Oh, my verse 12. I don't think it's the same verse number as yours is, but it's close enough. Is it not you, O God, who has until for now forsaken us and did not go forth, O God, with our legions? Give us help against our oppressors and the aid of man. The aid of man has been futile, but through God we should do valiantly. We will trample these oppressors of ours. This was the address, there's the last half of it, of David's referring to when he's talking about Edom, Amalek, Moab, Ammon, and Syria. What are they to Israel? Oppressors. Gives you a little bit of hint. So if David's attacking these individuals, what have they been doing for the previous 400 years to Israel? Oppressing. That's what they've been doing. So he said, well, so David's brutality is because they were being brutal back. Keep in mind, Moab, Ammon, these guys are, right word for it, but scoundrels. These are people who go through as raiding parties and take out parts of Israel. Where does all the tribes of Israel live? Well, I've done math before, but you got Reuben over here. Who are they surrounded by? Moab. You have Gad over here. Who are they surrounded by? Ammon. And Manasseh, or half tribe of Manasseh. Who are they surrounded by? Ammon and parts of Syria. What do they deal with continually throughout the entire history of Israel? Attacks, destruction, brutality. From whom? From Moab, from Ammon, from Syria. This is happening throughout all of history, Israel's history. That doesn't go away. So what is David doing essentially? Payback. But is it just venge? Is it just vengefulness? Yes, Ellie.
It's more than revenge. It's saying,
right,
don't tread on me.
In the long term.
Yeah.
David has one overarching objective here. And the objective that God assigned him. When God said, you will not build my temple, but your son will. David then got the marching orders from God. And the marching orders were, make sure your son can build that temple. Now what does that require? It requires utter and complete peace. Complete peace. If you're busy building a temple, can you go off to war? No. Does Solomon ever go to war? No. How did he able to accomplish that? That's what David did. David had to accomplish peace. Not just gaining money. It wasn't just revenge. It's actually to establish peace for his son. So what's what he did? Establish peace. Amalek, Ammon, none of these guys ever touched Israel during Solomon's reign. Didn't come close. They paid tribute. They took care of Israel. They respected Israel. All because of what David did. That's what he's doing. It wasn't brutality. It's not meanness. He's trying to accomplish the assigned task that God gave him. Establish peace for your son and get the money it costs to build the temple you have designed. Best way of doing it is instill fear in your enemies. And that's what he did. In a couple of chapters from now, we're going to actually discuss Aram, the reigning Syrians that are further away, come to fear and are not willing to assist their brethren in defending or fighting off David's men. They are afraid of him. They're afraid of Israel. That's how you get peace. Through strength. David established it. David knew it. And he made sure it happened. That's what he's doing for this chapter. It may seem tough. It may seem harsh. It's not. Keep in mind, it says quite plainly, God was with him. God made sure this happened. God made sure that the losses of Israel, the battles that they fought, they didn't lose the battle. They didn't lose that many men. They were successful in them. God blessed them in that effort. All in a single generation, which is quite talented. Yes, Jeff.
Same pattern is repeated in Revelation with the coming to rule with the rod of iron, followed by the dwelling of God in peace.
I was hoping you would say that. Ah, you're trustworthy sometimes, you know that. Sometimes. Oh, there's always somebody who rattles out something like that off, which is important, because that's actually one of the roles that David's playing here. We think of the Messiah, which we discussed previously in the previous chapter, as there's a conquering king, which Richard talked about that earlier for the Torah study. He comes out, he's forceful, there's destruction coming from him. But what other Messiah is discussed in the Revelation story? You have a peaceful one who establishes peace, who's getting married. Two different type of personalities, which we discussed that both David and Solomon are type of messianic figures. David was a conquering king, and that's exactly what he's doing, the conquering king, he's conquering. What is Solomon doing? The peaceful Messiah that's bringing all of Israel and all the people and even the Gentile nations all together to follow God. Two different aspects of the same man. In David's case, which is quite well put in Revelation chapter 5 and 6, points out the conquering king. We want to point out chapter 5, it discusses, if you recall, you can go there if you don't wish to, everybody's throwing down the praises of the Lamb of God. Oh, he's the conquering, he's the king, the everlasting king. And the praises are going up, the 24 elders are down on their feet, everybody's or knees, they're all praising the Lamb. Because he can break the seals of the scroll. Well, there's one phrase in there that I need to draw your attention to. It says that he is the king forever and ever. In Revelation. Well, I want to bring that phrase because the previous chapter, what promise did God give to David? You'll be king forever and ever. There are only some places that you are able to make connections to the Bible. When God decides to repeat a phrase from one spot to another spot, he's trying to make a connection that you and I will catch. So, and David and his descendants in chapter 7 are told, which most of us don't get to know our future, but David got to know his future, that you will be established as a king and your descendants established as king forever, meaning never ending. And then the Lamb comes along and discusses and uses a very similar phrase. You are king forever and ever. You're supposed to draw a connection. What's the first task the Lamb does? Well, he breaks the seal. And what's the very first thing that occurs? The seal's busted. A conquering king comes out, given a crown on his head to conquer and become conquering of everything around him. The white horse, as we're all familiar with it. That's supposed to draw your attention, because that white horse is characteristic of the Messiah. To do what? To conquer. And David is establishing that first step of the Messiah is return. Yes, Mary.
Did you already talk about the key of David?
Key of David?
In Revelation, how it said, I will give... I don't have it here, who shuts and no one opens, who opens and no one shuts. The key of David. What does that mean?
Revelation is not what I want to actually focus on today. It's related to David, but not in this particular chapter yet. I will go into that, but I don't want to touch it in chapter 8. That's going to show up a little bit closer to chapter 17. That one shows up. So we'll get there, so hold your question. I'll answer it try to answer it shortly. Whenever I get there. It takes me a long time to get through these chapters. So the series is going. David's a conquering king. He's just displaying that. He's displaying it for what purpose? To establish Solomon's peace, to establish lots of money, to build a temple, build the house of God. We see a lot of parallels here with Messiah's task. Why is it recorded for us? So that we would recognize the Messiah's task. As I mentioned before, many of the things that go through David's life are duplicates of what the Messiah does. It's as if God's writing down David's story and says, okay, what are you doing now? Okay, I'll make sure the Messiah does that too. What's your next task? Okay, I'll make sure the Messiah does that too. So people will recognize. Say, these events that David, which is a messianic figure, does, is supposed to be duplicated by the Messiah. That's how we would recognize who the Messiah is. Not just some Joe Blow that says, hey, it's me. You actually have to do certain things. If you don't do those certain things, you're not the right one. You may be very talented, you may be a prophet. That doesn't mean you're the Messiah himself. So these things are written down for us. So David's a conquering king at this point in time. Is he always a conquering king? No. Before he wasn't. And a few chapters earlier, when he was bringing the Ark of the Covenant from the house over into Jerusalem, what was he then? He was appraising. He was a priest. Is the Messiah a priest? Yeah, our Messiah is a priest. So David doesn't just play one role only throughout his life. He's just displaying a particular point of the Messiah's life right now in the conquering king. And the judge, of course, to teach us what we're supposed to be observing. Oh, let's see here. This is one thing that I think is wise. I'm going to point out to it. This chapter is very, very, very short. There's not a lot to discuss about it. David gathers all these various supplies and copper and gold and whatever else from the various other people. And of course, he gathers, you know, gifts and tributes from other people as well. And the one thing that David does, this is how we know this is a messianic prophecy. The one thing he does with all of these supplies, even the gifts, he immediately dedicates them to God. That's how you know something's unusual about this event. This isn't just some king gaining power. He's not using it for his personal gain, is he? He's not supplying any of his stuff. He's not gaining territory for his men, because what happens? Well, I think this chapter said it. Maybe the next chapter. He puts regents, people in charge of the cities, but where are the Israelites? Where do they live? They stay where their homes are. They don't go out. He's not popping. He's not colonizing. He's not gaining an empire. That wasn't his objective. He's gaining supplies and bringing it home. And keeping Israel home, where God gave them, the home that God placed for them. That's his objective. So it tells us this is a messianic act. This is not a gaining power act. Minor points, I guess. A couple of minor things to point out, which is just something I think is interesting. David the Lamb. In the Revelation's description, it points out that the horse that rides is pointed out and is described by whom? Who describes that point in Revelation chapter 6, verse 1 and 2? Does anybody recall? We'll go there in case you remember. I couldn't remember when I first read it either. There's another indicator how we know it's David that we're discussing and how he's connected to Lamb and to the Messiah, to this particular prophecy. The first seal says, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals," is the first seal. "I heard one of the four living creatures," which four living creature was it? "Saying, with a voice like thunder, come and see. And looked, behold, white horse, who sat upon it with a bowl, given a bow, a crown was given to him, he went out conquering and to conquer." Which creature said that? The clue is given in verse 3, let's see, and verse 5, and verse 7. Who said verse 3? Which creature is it? Say it again. The beast? Which creature of this beast? This is the creature saying, which one was it? Now, with the four creatures are on the throne. Which one's saying this? Yeah, the one am I conquering? Yes, thank you. The lion. How do you know it's a lion? It's a conquering one. So who says the number two? The number two is the fiery red horse. Went out, granted one to sit on the throne to take peace from the earth. And people should kill one another. This should be given to him a great sword. Who says that one? I'm bringing this out to you. But yes, the bull. The bull said that one. I'm bringing this out to you because it's going to show up to you in the next few chapters as David does different aspects of God and of the Messiah. Yes. Thank you. Yes. Say a little louder. I don't think I ever heard you that. It's a bull. Animal sacrifice, and what's being sacrificed here? A lot of God's people being sacrificed here. And the third one. I heard seven, see a black horse, a pair of scales in his hand. Therefore, a quart of wheat for denarius, or 3 quarts of barley for denarius, do not harm the oil and the wine. Who says that one? He gives you a hint. What's being said tells you who said it. Does a lion have discernment on what is just and what is not just? Huh? Does a calf have discernment on what is just and what is unjust? Does an eagle have discernment on what is just and what is unjust? Does a human being have a discernment what is just and unjust? Okay, the man told you what it. Thank you. Okay, number 4. Who read this one? It's a pale horse. Death and Hades followed with him. He was given a fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with hunger, death, and the beasts of the earth. Which one says that one? Process of elimination. The fourth creature, which would be the eagle. Why is the eagle doing that one? It eats carrion, eats dead things. It decides what dies and what is dying and kills it or eats it off. They look above, high above the earth and watch the ground and see what's dying and what's worth eating. They're the ones who decide that. Now, of course, there's another clue there. I'm not saying just by what they say. It actually specifically states here, I heard the second living creature on verse 3, the third living creature on verse 5, and the fourth living creature. It's the, like a specific the, which, of course, discusses them in order of previous chapter, which kind of, you know, gives you a dead giveaway who said what. But that's a helpful little hint there. So what I want to point out to you is the first section, the Lion of Judah. What is the Lion of Judah's job? To conquer. Is the Lion of Judah's job to judge? No, it's not. What was David's one weakness? His judgment? What is the one thing that his son is known for that he was not? Wisdom and judgment. When David and Solomon are both brought before them a similar scenario, David sees the situation as, I don't know which one's right. Solomon comes along and sees the same scenario, this is judging which person's lying, and says, I know how I can tell which one's telling the truth. Solomon figures it out. David's coming along as a lion. He eventually also, Ephraim comes along as the calf, which we'll discuss that when we get to what David has Ephraim do, the tribes of Ephraim do for him. And Solomon comes along as the man who discerns what is right, what is just, what is truth. We'll discuss as these men go along this process. But these men are written for us, not just for our own personal enjoyment of their life story. They're written for us so we would discern what is a messianic act. What does a godly person do versus what does a godly person do not do or doesn't do? So we can recognize when we say, oh, okay, now I know where these stories of revelations and all these various parallels and what they're talking about, what they're referring to. So we can recognize people corresponds to this individual. So when we're looking for this white horse, looking around, it's supposed to conquer and do conquering. Is that all we're supposed to look for? Somebody goes out there and conquers? Are we looking for God to come out and just conquer stuff? No. We're looking for God to act like David did. That's what we're doing. To recognize the answers of revelations, you have to look back, as we asked for Richard talking about earlier, the hindsight gives you insight. You have to look back and say, okay, what is it that God's trying to tell us? It gives us a reference here in Revelation. We go back, okay, who was like that? Oh, David was. What did he do? Write down everything you did, that same person, those same events, those same actions are supposed to be indicative that we may recognize from the conquering one who was the conqueror is also supposed to do. To do the same thing David just did. Will it be brutal? Yeah, it's going to be brutal. But where is it focused around? The temple of God. The house of God. Is a conquering king coming to conquer the one we're waiting for in Revelation, discussing here in the white horse? Is he coming to conquer Indonesia? Why? Why is it not Indonesia? Because Indonesia has nothing to do with the temple of God. Is he coming to conquer chili. That's good fruit there, but that's what else got going on for. No, why? Because it has nothing to do with the temple of God. So conquering horse is supposed to come and conquer, and if we recognize it, he's supposed to do what David did. Follow the temple of God. Get all the peace required and all the supplies required to build God's home. May God have peace. These objectives, these are written here for us to see this stuff and remember it and know what we're looking at when we read the headlines of the papers or off the internet websites, off Drudge Report, whatever you have to get your information from. That we recognize what we're seeing and where we're supposed to be looking. So we observe, we see what David did, we make a mental note, this is supposed to happen again. Maybe in a grander scale, maybe in a different scale, but it's the same principle. It's all supposed to build God's house. Yes. Grander scale, go ahead.
The white horse.
Okay.
Conquering.
Yes.
And then also the Spirit of God, you know, coming into the temples of our being, you know, in the heart and in the mind. Could it be also applied to the conquering of God's Spirit with the gospel throughout the planet?
Yeah, say that again. Conquering of God's Spirit with the gospel throughout the planet?
Yeah.
So you're referring to as far as like the distribution of the Word of God throughout the planet, thus conquering of
the
minds
and
beliefs to draw
yes,
to
God. Yes, when
God.
I mean, you know, in the work of as the work of the apostles and the early church went forth, you know, conquering, you know, with the gospel.
In one of the aspects, that's correct, but only one of them. In that, yes, that's one of the principles behind God's Word. It said, "Scatter throughout, and you will cover all the people." But the assignment given was given to the apostles to do what in particular? To go conquer and go to hearts and minds and beliefs to follow God of the descendants of Abraham. That's what they were all assigned. Only the apostle Paul was assigned to do something beyond that. Everybody else was assigned one task. To gather the people of Israel at that point, at that assignment. So apostle Paul comes along and of course expands it to Gentiles as well through a particular route that they can follow to get to God as well. It does conquer, but it doesn't conquer in the same fashion that David's conquering, because all those hearts and minds and beliefs are not sending their support and assistance to building God's house in Jerusalem or in that area. They build an aspect of God's house, and a spiritual aspect of it, but not a physical one. This is the descriptions given to us both in the prophets as well as the apostles, the gospels as well as Revelation. Tells there's a physical component to this as well as a spiritual one. So in a manner of speaking, you're absolutely right. But that's about half of it. Because the spiritual aspect as opposed to just the physical as well. It has to be both. So in one aspect, it's very quick to do what you're suggesting. And that one person can be convinced in a matter of a few events that God puts in their life. In the other side, it takes a very long time because you have a lot of people to go through. Millions, billions, whatever. So all those things add to your overall global expansion. Is that the only thing, though? I think that's part of it. I think the spiritual aspect is part of it. Yes, Ellie.
For all of the nations to be brought in before the Feast of Trumpets is fulfilled is out of time. Because the Feast of Trumpets is fulfilled by Messiah coming for the two families, his two families, their atonement. And then comes the Feast of Sukkot, in which all of the 70 nations are taught and brought in. So we can't get them in until the time for that happens.
Yeah, that's true. I think what he was referring to is that you cannot gather even the nations from a distance unless you already have inside them some knowledge or some wisdom that there is a God, and the particular God that you're desiring to follow, to one that exists. So in a manner of speaking, that they are being conquered currently and have been for a couple thousand years, or not longer than that. But not as a nation, but rather as individuals. It's a little bit different than how God's working with them. Yes, Jeff?
Well, one thing that Hector was bringing out is the idea of that message going out. But message does go out, but what happens to the enemies of the message? To truly have peace and freedom, the enemies of the message have to be put down at some point. It's kind of like
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
today we have like hostage negotiators. The hostage negotiator reasons and pleads with the person, look, your judgment's coming here. The SWAT team is ready. Will you put down and give up? At some point, if he doesn't give up, the judgment comes in his respect.
That's a great way of putting it. Thank you. That's a great way of putting it. But yeah, I couldn't have said it were better myself.
Is he measuring people's height in verse 2?
No, quantity. Number of people.
Quantity. Okay, that's okay.
Took a rope.
I wasn't sure if it went
said,
this way or that way.
Yeah, no, it's the rope length. So he split two-thirds here, one-third there, this third die, this third live.
Okay.
Tough, yeah. You hope you're not in the two-thirds category, but you don't know what the plan is before while he's dividing it up. Any other comments or questions? Have a wonderful remaining Shabbat.